I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Rodney Brooks, co-founder of Rethink, a company that makes robots for the manufacturing industry. Rethink's first robot was introduced in 2012 and is named Baxter. In 1990, Dr. Brooks founded iRobot, which makes robots for the consumer and defense industries. iRobot's first consumer product was the Roomba, a vacuum robot introduced in 2002. The company went public in 2005 and is headquartered outside of Boston, Massachusetts. Dr. Brooks was formerly on the faculty at MIT from 1984 to 2010. His influential paper, entitled Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control, was the inspiration for the Errol Morris documentary of the same name in 1997, in which Dr. Brooks is featured. Welcome.
Thanks for having me here.
Could you please define what a robot is?
Well, it's a bit like trying to define what art is, but I use the definition the robot is something that senses the world, does some computation, and then decides to act outside the extent of its own body. And I say outside the extent of its own body because I can't stand the thought of a dishwashing machine being a robot. It's not intelligent enough to me.
In 1990, you started your first robot company called iRobot with the intention to produce practical robots. What did you intend to build and to bring out to the market when you first launched the company?
When we first launched the company, we really didn't know. We were a bit naive, more than a bit naive. We knew we had technology to make robots mobile and move around, and we thought, well, everyone's going to like this technology. We'll just start a company. We've got a list of 14 failed business models we went through before we finally got the Roomba in 2002 and the military robots at the same time, and then we went public in 2005. But we had 14 failed business models, which weren't all bad models, just the world wasn't quite ready for some of them.
And what's one example of a model that the world wasn't ready for?
Well, one example was we were doing nuclear power plant inspection robots with the Japanese government, funded by MITI, Ministry of International Trade and Industry, partnered with Mitsubishi Heavy Industries. We did the research. We couldn't get traction for it to be a product until March of 2011, 1 week after the disaster, the Japanese government called iRobot. I was still on the board at that time, and said, please send some robots to Japan.
So instead of launching with a nuclear power plant robot, you launched with a vacuum cleaner. How did that happen?
Well, we had 14 models that we'd looked at, 14 different sorts of products. And all along, people said, well, I'd like a robot to clean my home. Back in 1990 or 1991 at my lab at MIT, we'd actually built a prototype vacuum cleaning robot. It wasn't very good. So eventually, towards the end of the 1990s, where we had learned to do low-cost manufacturing in China because we'd been doing toy robots for a while, we decided to have another go at building a vacuum cleaning robot. It wasn't the first vacuum cleaning robot on the market. The first one was from Electrolux for 2,000 euros in Europe. The key decision we made was we figured out that $200 was a price point that a person could spend without getting their spouse's approval. And so that became the target. The first model was $199.99,
wow.
September 18th, 2002.
You've said before that the robotic revolution parallels the PC revolution. And you've mentioned that when computers started to become more pervasive, they found their ways in toys and games initially before becoming more robust and complicated. Similarly, it seems like the Trojan horse for robots is also in toys and games and vacuums.
Yeah, well, in terms of the absolute number of robots, vacuum cleaning robots are more than any other sort of robot by far in the world. Industrial robots that are currently in factories really, to me, are like the mainframes of 30 years ago. Ordinary people can't touch them because they're dangerous. They're very hard to program. And then the PC came along around 1980, and slowly it started to get into offices, and ordinary office workers got to control computation. And the spreadsheet was the first killer app, if you like, where ordinary people could program the computer without having to be programmers. So we're trying to do the similar sort of thing for industrial robots, that ordinary factory workers can learn in minutes how to get it to do new tasks.
Just as the PC did not replace the human being and made the human being more ostensibly efficient, your claim with Rethink is that these robots for manufacturing are also assisting the human rather than replacing the
human being. Very much so. I we didn't get rid of office workers. There's lots of office workers around. Now, the tasks that office workers do are very different from the tasks they did 30 years ago. They're much more empowered. And so I see a similar sort of thing with these industrial robots.
Could you walk through some of the other examples of robots that you've built? On the military side, you have these small unmanned ground vehicles that were launched in Afghanistan, for example. What other applications are there of these robots?
We built a lot of custom robots over time. We built some for NASA for experiments with Mars rovers to develop the software for exploring Mars. We built a robot for National Geographic that went into the Great Pyramid and crawled up a little tiny tunnel and cut a hole through to a cavity that was known to be behind there. It was very small, just diameter of the tunnel was just a few inches, so a person couldn't get up there. Then the robot drilled a hole through to see what was inside this cavity, and there was nothing there.
And when you were starting the company and you were seeking venture capital, I mean, this is the nascent stages of the robotics industry. What did that landscape look like?
Well, we didn't actually go after venture capital in 1990. It was totally self-funded, and we would get contracts and ask for half the money up front because we had to float, you know, our payroll. In fact, for the first 8 or 9 years, we never knew that we were going to make payroll at the end of the month. We always did, though.
Hmm.
So it wasn't until 1998 that we started getting venture capital. It was 1998. It was boom times for the internet. I remember the most depressing interchange was Colin, Helen, and I, the three co-founders, on an August afternoon. It was hot. We were sweaty. We go into this one place, and they send out a summer intern, a junior in college, to talk to us. We start telling him what we're doing, and a few minutes in, he looks at us, he says, "You mean you build stuff? No one builds stuff anymore." And that was the end. So in fact, I went off and started my own venture fund. Got some money from some Swiss pension funds and started a little venture fund with some people I knew called Robotic Ventures. And we did a few investments, but I realized I wasn't very good at being a venture capitalist. We did fine, but you know, I like pushing the boundaries of things that are almost impossible. And the role of a venture capitalist is to put discipline on the entrepreneur. I was just the opposite.
And then fast forward to 2008, when you founded Rethink Robotics, you had an easier time raising capital after the success of iRobot. You and Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon, were the early investors.
Yeah, when I founded Rethink Robotics, it was very much going to be a venture-based company. I put in some money, and Jeff Bezos' personal investment vehicle put in the other money for the very first Series A1, as we came to call it.
How did you meet Jeff?
Well, I met Jeff a long time ago. I first met him at TED, Technology, Entertainment, and Design Conference, and he was actually an investor in iRobot before it went public.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Rodney Brooks, co-founder of Rethink Robotics, a company that produces robots for the manufacturing industry. Dr. Brooks is professor emeritus at MIT. What was the catalyst for leaving iRobot and going to Rethink? I know that they are focused on different industries, but were there any pivot moments for you?
Well, I had spent from 1997, I'd been going to China to learn to do low-cost manufacturing. I came to realize that was not going to be sustainable in the long term, that costs were going up in China. Even in the late 90s, if you were doing sewing for toys, that had already moved to Vietnam. So I could see sort of the writing on the wall. I sort of saw that people would want to do more manufacturing back in the United States. Had to be more productive. So I, being a robot guy, my answer was, let's have robots for manufacturing. But then people asked me, why didn't I do it inside iRobot? iRobot was sitting on a lot of cash, well over $100 million at the time I started Rethink Robotics. But if they spend that cash on a long-term development program, it comes off the bottom line. And Wall Street would slap them. So I presented the idea to the board, and as I expected, the board said, no, we can't spend our cash on that. I was under all sorts of agreements with them. They got equity in Rethink Robotics in return for releasing me from some of those agreements and got outside capital to start Rethink Robotics.
Now, Baxter's the name of the robot that you've launched. It costs $22,000. What does Baxter look like?
Well, Baxter's red and black. It has humanoid form. It has two arms. It has a LCD screen where the face would be, and normally there are eyes animated on that face, and the face always points towards any person who's nearby the robot. And when it's about to reach for something, the eyes glance at where it's about to reach. So if you're working in close proximity to it, it doesn't surprise you with an unexpected motion. It's a bit bigger than a human being. We tried to have it have human reach, but it doesn't have any hips, so we had to make longer arms. So I say it's like an Olympic swimmer is the size of the arms.
You mentioned Baxter's eyes. Are they functional or more social so that people interact with him as if he were a human being?
Yeah, we call Baxter an it because I try to make my robots deliver on any promise they give in their appearance. And I don't know what to promise in terms of gender, so I always call them its. The eyes... There is a camera right above the LCD screen, so it is actually seeing. But the animated eyes are really to give a person an understanding of what the robot is paying attention to.
Just on the subject of humanoid robots, what are the benefits of creating a robot that looks human-like?
Well, actually, when I started Rethink Robotics, I didn't believe we were going to build a humanoid robot. That was not the original intent. But over time, as we talked to many potential customers, a lot of them said they wanted to be able to replace the robot with a person. So that if the robot went down, they could just get a person in to take over temporarily so it didn't slow things down. Hmm. So they wanted the reliability of replacing with a person. Now, that led us to build a robot with human-like capabilities in terms of what sort of things it could lift up, 5 pounds at full extension, and how fast it could move.
I've read before that one potential disadvantage of making a robot too human-like is that people might have disproportionate expectations of what it could do. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, so I say that if you make your robot look just like Albert Einstein, it better be as smart as Albert Einstein, otherwise people are going to be disappointed. Mm-hmm. So we tried to make Baxter look up, have the appearance of about how smart it is, which is not really very smart.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the roboticist, Dr. Rodney Brooks. We'll hear more from Dr. Brooks coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Rodney Brooks, co-founder of Rethink, a company that makes robots for the manufacturing industry. In 1990, Dr. Brooks founded iRobot, which makes robots for the consumer and defense industries. iRobot's first consumer product was the Roomba, a vacuum robot introduced in 2002. Dr. Brooks was formerly on the faculty at MIT from 1984 to 2010. I've heard you say before there are four things needed to solve issues with robotics. Do you want to tell what they are?
So I've been telling people in research for a while that there are four aspirational goals. If we make improvement in any of these four, just improvement, the robots will get a lot better. So the first thing is the visual capabilities of a two-year-old child. A two-year-old child, you can show them objects. You can show them a pair of glasses. They'll tell you it's glasses. You can show them a set of keys that they've never seen before. They'll tell you it's a set of keys. So getting to visual object identification capabilities of a two-year-old child. The language capabilities of a four-year-old child. A four-year-old child can understand accents. You don't have to dumb down the grammar. They may not know all the words, but they're learning words at an incredible rate. They understand questions. They understand conditionals. They understand a bunch of stuff at age four. At age six, the manual dexterity of a six-year-old child. A six-year-old child can tie shoelaces. A six-year-old child can do any task that is asked of a Chinese factory worker. They have that dexterity. They may not be able to play Chopin on the piano, but they've got the dexterity to do any sort of cooking task, any sort of task in the house. they're so inclined. And the last one is the social understanding of an 8-year-old child. It's really a 9-year-old child, but I say 8 to make it a pattern, where an 8 or 9-year-old child understands that a person different from them has a different understanding of the world, and they can reason about what that person knows because of what that person has been exposed to and seen in the world, and they don't make the mistake of thinking that everyone has the same model of the world as they do. If we had all those four capabilities, we would have the, you know, robots beyond my imagination.
And if this ideal robot were achieved, could the robot mature to be an older humanoid, you know, individual through pattern recognition and repetition, just as humans could?
It may. You know, our robot, even Baxter, does some sort of learning. But learning is such a loaded term because when human learning is so rich. So I didn't ask for the richness of human-level learning in those four capabilities. I was trying to make pretty much a robot that's a useful tool.
How much has your understanding of human behavior and the chemistry of the human body, how much have you had to enrich your understanding of those systems, even the spiritual life and the physical life of a human being, to help you in your robotic work?
During the 90s, my students and I at MIT really looked at child development a lot as inspiration for how to build the subsystems that could make up a robot that was adaptable to the world. Mm-hmm. And so that inspired us in trying to understand what software modules we needed to build to process sensory information and to control dexterous actuation.
You are considered a pioneer in the field of behavior-based robotics. And essentially, you advocate using decentralized systems to create robots rather than a centralized system. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, and I'll tell you how it fits in the Baxter context, actually. So you could have a top-down planning system where the wanted the robot to do some task, and it would plan out ahead of time every single step and then follow that plan. And a lot of traditional AI, artificial intelligence, tries to do that. Baxter has lots of little behaviors that run in parallel. So, for instance, its arms will not collide with each other. If you try to bring them close together, they'll push each other away. It knows, a little rule knows, that it can't put something down unless it has something in its hand. So it has lots of little simple rules like that, which make it adaptable to a changing environment because it's not pre-computing exactly what it's going to do ahead of time. It's reacting to what's in the environment through many, many parallel, simple little behaviors.
Why did you pioneer this shift from centralized, you know, robotics to decentralized system? What do you see as the advantage?
Well, back in the 1980s, I was looking at trying to make robots navigate around in the world, and the computations were getting more and more complex. And I looked at little insects, and little insects with just 100,000 neurons were able to fly around and do all sorts of things we couldn't make a robot do with a big mainframe computer. So I realized there had to be a different way of organizing things.
In addition to studying childhood development to better inform your work, have you also thought, you know, just on a larger scale about, like, what human beings are? Like, what is your view of human life?
So I for a long time I was confused by how someone could be both a scientist and be religious. It didn't make sense to me. I'm an atheist. And then I realized that in my own life I had a duality of interpretations of the world. So if I look at carefully at a person, they're a big bag of skin full of biomolecules which operate according to rules and are predictable in a sense. But my own children, I love unconditionally. I don't treat them as bags of skin full of biomolecules. I have two different ways of being in the world. I have the scientist way and the father way. And so I realize that we all have multiple views of the world, which we use at different times, and we're actually pretty comfortable about holding mutually inconsistent sets of belief. So, yes, I think we are all robotic, chemical robots. That is what we human beings are. And by the way, all of modern science actually believes that. It's all about van der Waals forces and things like that. But people then have a different view of humans, which can be very spiritual or very religious.
Now, you know, your view of humans being chemical robots, you know, might not sit well with some people. And I've heard you say before how it's been hard for society to some extent to accept our lack of specialness. You know, we started off thinking we were the center of the universe and the sun revolved around us. And God
had made the earth for us because we were the peak of creation. And the one that really got it for me was Garry Kasparov. Garry Kasparov was beaten by Deep Blue, the world chess champion. Garry is a very sweet guy. I met him just a few months ago. But when he was beaten by Deep Blue in the 90s, the IBM supercomputer that beat him at chess, when he was beaten, he got up and he said, well, at least it didn't enjoy beating me. Because he still had the specialness that he had emotions, but the computer didn't have emotions. So, and I realize we're always trying to be special. We want to be special.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Rodney Brooks, co-founder of Rethink Robots, a company that produces robots for the manufacturing industry. Dr. Brooks is a professor emeritus at MIT. Incidentally, you mentioned you have children. You have four children. Are any of them in the field of robotics? What do they do?
None of my four children are in robotics, but my youngest daughter is actually an entrepreneur in Silicon Valley making engineering toys for young girls.
I want to talk about your upbringing. You grew up in Adelaide, Australia. Your father was a telephone technician, and your mother was a hairdresser. You spent some time as a child tinkering with leftover rocket equipment. Your dad was initially a telephone technician, but then he worked in a testing facility to help Europe build its first satellite launch system. Can you describe some of those early moments?
I actually had a book, the How and Why Wonder Book of Electricity, and another book, the How and Why Wonder Book of Computers and Giant Brains. And I got them when I was about 7 years old. They were American books. And they just gave a little bit enough information for me to start building simple circuits. And for some reason, I wanted to build intelligent systems. So when I was about 7 or 8, I built a computer, I called it, which was made out of nails and light bulbs out of flashlights and batteries and wires, which could play a very simple game where you took turns in taking away between 1 and 4 matches from a pile, and whoever ended up with the last match lost or won or something. And I built a circuit that could play that. And then I really worked hard. And by the time I was 12, getting a little more sophisticated switches out of old office switchboards as surplus equipment, I was able to build a computer, as I called it, which could play tic-tac-toe and not be beaten. And I wanted to build robots, but I wasn't dexterous enough to get things that could actually mechanically move. I could build circuits, but it wasn't until I was around 15 or 16 that I built my first robot.
And, you know, so you built your first simple circuit computer at 7 or 8 years old. Were your parents like, oh, that's nice. Okay, come in for dinner.
Well, actually, it was a little weird in that. I wasn't allowed to do it during the week because I had to watch TV like a normal kid. And on the weekends, I wasn't allowed to stay out in the lab, which was in a shed in the back garden, past 5 p.m. So I had to learn how to be. I'd think all week what I was going to do on the weekend, what I was going to build, and then I'd get in there and go at it as quick as possible.
Now, you were one of four children. Did your siblings participate in this?
My older brother had a chemistry set and in the same back garden shed, but no, they were not as dedicated to this as I was. I was an anomaly. In fact, my mother finished 10th grade, my father finished 9th grade, and at age 4, everyone called me the professor because somehow I was weird from birth.
You call it weird, but did you have a sense of self and, you know, continued confidence to say, okay, I am smart? Like,
well, I could do things, mental arithmetic in my head. I don't know what it was, except by age 4, I knew that I was better at computation, arithmetic, than any adult. It was just something, a gift. It was something in me.
Now, there was one computer in Adelaide, Australia, and you had exposure to it.
When I was younger, there was an IBM computer mainframe in the city that you could see through a glass wall, and I would go and look at that. By the time I got to be an undergraduate at one of the local universities,
Flinders
University, they had a 16 kilobyte computer with four full-time operators running it during the week. And you could punch your cards, submit them, and 24 hours later you could get your printout. But one of the professors really understood that maybe I, you know, had a lot of interest in this. And he arranged that over the weekend, I was allowed to use that computer by myself for 12 hours every Sunday. So from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. on Sundays, I had that computer with one other student. And I got to recreate and learn computer science myself. There was no computer science being taught, but I got to learn it and figure it out for myself.
Now, you are so focused on, you know, math and arithmetic and computers and artificial intelligence at the time. How about your social life, your social development? Did you have girlfriends? And
I wasn't real good with girlfriends, but I did play various sports and went to parties.
You made your way to the United States. Initially, you went to Stanford and got a PhD at Stanford. How did being in the United States change possibilities for you, if at all?
I came to Stanford in 1977. And, you know, that was sort of the blooming of Silicon Valley. And I came from somewhere where there were almost no computers. And, you know, I would be in a McDonald's and hear people talking about software and programming at the next table. It was just such a different environment. And so I really was able to get immersed. I was able to, you know, go to Xerox PARC and see the Alto at the same time that Steve Jobs was seeing the Alto and the mouse and the Windows.
The Alto being the...
The Alto was the computer built at Xerox PARC and was what essentially Apple copied to make the Macintosh.
And after getting your PhD at Stanford, you ended up at MIT, but it took you a few years to finally become on the faculty. And you said, even despite your rejections, you just kept trying. And there's a quote you once said that rejection is not the end.
No, rejection is not the end. I did not get accepted to MIT as a graduate student. I applied for a faculty job there three times before I eventually got a faculty job. And the other rejection is I actually failed my qualifying exam at Stanford in artificial intelligence. First exam I'd ever failed in my life.
Why did you know upon taking the exam that, oh boy, I'm failing?
I did not know that. I had got there and I was full of confidence and I just wasn't ready for the qualifying exam, so I failed.
When you finally did become professor at MIT in the 1980s, you developed various robots with students in your robotics lab, and eventually you met your iRobot co-founders, Colin Angle and Helen Grainer. By the way, I was surprised to see that one of your co-founders, Helen, is a woman. How many of your students are women?
I had 27 PhD students, and I believe that 10 or 11 of them were women. Mm-hmm. So I had a lot more women in my lab than most robotics labs.
Is that ratio roughly the norm?
It really occurred because I had one woman, Anita Flynn. She had actually been at the Naval Academy, was really strong, aggressive, and new leadership. And that made it safe for other women to come in and join the lab. And then it just became a tradition that women worked in my lab and more came.
You were a faculty member at MIT for a quarter of a century. And so you kind of had this hybrid life where you were on both sides, both, you know, the academic life, but also the business world. Did that ever create conflicts within the university? Because more and more you had these professors entering business.
I was very careful to separate my two lives. So when we started iRobot, which was based on mobile robotics, I stopped doing mobile robot research and shifted to humanoid robot research because that was going to be a place that iRobot was never going to go. So my grad students would not be worried that what they were doing with me as a research project was somehow feeding into my company.
Here we are, you know, just at the beginning of the robot revolution where you saw PCs in the 1980s. Where do you see robots, let's say, 100 years from now?
I think robots are going to be pervasive, or robotic systems. Now, back in 1980, if you told people that they would have computers in their kitchens in the 1990s, they would have thought you were crazy. But instead, by the mid-1990s, there were computers, there were microprocessors in everyone's kitchen. So the robots that will appear in our world will not necessarily be the robots of science fiction or the robots of Hollywood, but robotic technology will be everywhere. So, for instance, Toyota, in their robot division, have recently announced a robot to help elderly people get into and out of bed. Doesn't look like a humanoid robot at all. It lets someone have a little more dignity and live at home longer, an elderly person, live at home longer because they can do stuff for themselves with that robotic technology, which otherwise they would need people to help them get into and out of bed.
Your mother is still alive. Your father passed away. What does she think of what you've become?
She's very proud of me, but she doesn't really understand my life. In fact, most of my friends in Australia from those days don't understand the sort of life I have. You know, they'd be, what do you mean you only teach one course? Being at MIT is just a little part-time job. They didn't understand the idea of a major research university. So it's a very different life from what I came from.
Just in your practical daily life, what are your encounters with robots in your own home? That maybe have you created any for you, for yourself, to help you make cereal in the morning?
I don't have any special robots. I do have a scuba, the small scuba that cleans my bathroom floor. I was using Roombas for a while, but I must admit I have a cleaning service right now that comes in and does that. But the scuba keeps my bathroom floor very clean.
Is there anything else that you feel a pain point in your home? Like, oh, I'd love to have something that makes my bed. Or
no, I sleep in an unmade bed.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Dr. Rodney Brooks. Coming up, we'll meet Andrew Goldsworthy, a leading sculptor who uses outdoor materials like wood, stone, and leaves. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is the sculptor Andy Goldsworthy. Andy's sculptures are made out of wood, stone, ice, leaves, water, and mud, and can last anywhere from a few seconds to hundreds of years. Andy lives in Scotland, but his work has been exhibited widely in the United States, including at the National Gallery in Washington, D.C., the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City, Stanford and Princeton universities, and the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art in California. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
You spend so much of your time working outdoors, and I'm wondering what your relationship with the outdoors was when you were growing up.
As a kid? Oh, wow. I had a regular sort of time as a child. You know, I played in woods and on the beach. I don't remember making many sculptures as a kid, but art was always very important to me. That was the only thing I could do. That's the only thing I was made for, was to make art. It was the driving passion through all my education.
Were your parents artists?
No, my mother looked after us kids, and my father was a professor, a university professor of mathematics.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up on the outskirts of Leeds, which is a big city in the north of England. On one side was the city, and on the other side were the fields, the green belt, as they called it. So it's this really interesting edge between the two, and I think that probably had a big effect on the way I see things. Walking through the new suburbs, I always remembered where the trees were, where the swamps were, and I could, you know, it's just underneath this veneer of tarmac and building, the swamps and the trees were still there somehow. And I think that definitely informs how I look at the urban spaces now. It's like trying to get through the surface appearance of things to what is the, you know, the nature of an urban place.
When did it first occur to you that you wanted to have a career in this type of sculpture?
Well, I think career is probably the wrong word to use for an artist. You make art. And if a career happens through that, then great. But when you sign up for art, you could be signing up for working as a part-time gardener or whatever, just to support your work and have a very frugal life in terms of material things. But obviously have a fantastic life in terms of what you gain through what you make. I am very, very fortunate to be able to have both, you know, that I can make a living from my work.
But you haven't always had both.
Absolutely not, no. When I was a student, I lived off very little. And when I left college, I lived off very little too. And for the first 8 years, it was like that. And I worked as a part-time gardener and other things.
You also worked on a farm. How did farming inform your work at all?
That was very important. Farming is a very sculptural activity. You know, the way haystacks are made, the ploughing of a field. And it's also a very, at times, a very brutal experience being on a farm. There's the death of animals, the rawness of working with the land, the weather, the harshness of it, as well as an intense period. It was a very powerful experience. When you're picking potatoes all day long, or picking wild oats from a field of oats, stacking bales, you do these long, repetitive tasks. And you build up a certain working rhythm, and that helps enormously when I'm making sculptures.
It implies a sense of patience, in a way, to be able to do the same thing and tolerate that over and over again. Do you feel intellectually stimulated by picking potatoes or doing your sculptures?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I don't consider myself to be incredibly patient. I'm very determined. Patience is something to do with knitting. It's like it's too intense to describe it in that way. The unpredictability and very tedious and repetitive.
Where does this come from? Were you always, as a child, a hardworking, intense individual?
Well, I wasn't considered particularly gifted academically. And I did pretty badly in a lot of the subjects at school, except for art. I'd have always done out with a certain obsessiveness, yeah.
Do you remember the first time you made money from your art?
Yeah, I was shortly after I left art school. At that time, the Arts Council of Britain used to buy art and make an exhibition every year, and it was a great honour for the purchaser that year was Dr. Andrew Causey, who was at Manchester University, and he bought some early photographs of mine, and I'll never forget it because he had to talk me up to £30.
What do your photographs go for these days?
Do you know, I have no idea. I imagine a few $1,000s, but not huge. I mean, this is a really stupid kind of... I mean you, how many people have you interviewed that said what I've just said? I mean, obviously, I do care. I'm sure there's some... I have files somewhere that will tell me exactly how much they paid.
I want to talk about the themes in your art. One theme that's recurring is the sense of time. How did the sense of time come into play, or how does the sense of time come into play with your work for some listeners who aren't aware of your work?
Well, when I first began working outside, one of the very earliest works that I made outside on the beach was made in many ways as a reaction to the static studio that I was supposed to be working in as a student. Which I found incredibly difficult to work with. It's this place that didn't change, typically a white cube that students are given to work in. So you were met with these very contrasting images and experiences. You know, the college was very confined, very closed, very controlled, and this beach, which was different every day. And one day I just went out and made a couple of things on the beach, and the tide came in and washed them away, and I suddenly realized that I wasn't in control and time was dictating what I should make, how I could make it. And many of the earlier works were made for the moment in which they were made. And then later on I began to realize that moment is the way it is because of what has happened before. And then time became even more important to me. And then I began to think of the future too. For instance, making a stone cairn on the beach, waiting for the tide to come in and engulf it.
You talk about a stone cairn, C-A-I-R-N.
Mm-hmm. Although my cairns don't look like any other cairn that's ever been made, my cairns are often, they look more like a pine cone. I like to call them cairns because I like this association to marking a moment, a place, a journey.
To me, they look like eggs, and they have that fragility sometimes when they are part of the beach and they might be torn down by the tides.
I do not see stone as something static or dead. I try to see it as something alive and living.
What do you mean by there is an inner life in stone?
Well, I don't mean in some slight kind of hippie sort of yaya way. Stone, you know, you look at the granite of Manhattan, you know, that's a fire-formed material, you know, and you go into Central Park and you see where it's exposed and revealed. There's a certain flow and movement and a sense of change about that, even though it is solid. You know, I've actually made sculptures where I've fired stones, taken solid stones and fired them in a kiln and seen them turn liquid. Very violent, but it's very, very powerful to see this stone tearing apart.
Did the kiln break?
My father-in-law at the time, he was a potter, and I borrowed his kiln in the early days. And yes, one of the I wrecked a kiln.
By the way, when you would go home during school to work on the beach, what did your teachers think of that? Was there any controversy surrounding that?
It was a little difficult for the tutors. I was rejected from three art colleges before I got in one at the end. I had more or less given up going to art school. I was going to go and be an artist. I was going the direct route. I wasn't going to bother with this. So, but my father, being in universities, rang round and found a place. He drove me for my interview, and I was the last but one person to be accepted at Lancaster Art College. Now, all those rejections were really, really kind of a bit of a shock, but they change you dramatically. And through that process of rejection, I became very, very independently minded.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the sculptural artist Andy Goldsworthy. Are most of your innovations by accident?
Intuition is incredibly important. And the ephemeral work made outside for the moment, for the day, is made in the spirit of experimentation. I make an awful lot of bad work. There are things that go wrong. You know, things go wrong, can fail. It's important that they do fail. And that is the food. That's the lifeblood of my work. And it is driven by intuition.
Your work and your, at least in the early days, ability to live so frugally implies a rich spiritual life. What religion are you?
None. I was brought up a Methodist. My father's mother and father were Methodist, but I'm not religious. What I do has a spiritual content to it. I mean, the feeling for place, understanding of a place and my place and my relationship to the people who've been there before me, the people who will come after me. I just recently did a work for the Yorkshire Sculpture Park containing a large flat-bedded rock. I lay down on the rock. It began to snow. I got up and left a shadow. And that stone has been laid on there as an invitation for others to lay on the rock and leave their shadow. And I like this sense of the stone becoming ingrained with the memory of the people who've laid upon it.
What about the physical toll that your work has on you? I'm trying to look at your hands. Can I see your hands? You haven't had a manicure in a while.
No, I've never had a manicure in my life.
Let me see them again. Put them on the table.
Well, that one, that kind of squash finger there is from working on the farm where I dropped the back of a trailer on it. I got one knuckle missing here from banging that. I got a good one here from a piece of slate. We were doing a test. Testing out the material for the National Gallery piece in Washington. I went to the quarries and that slipped me up there. But I mean, generally, they're not in bad condition considering what I do.
You have a few books of your work, and one of your books is called Time. You talk about how you need the resistance of weather to help you work more. You like in the early afternoon when the day is the hottest, that's when you work best.
Well, actually, that sentence came out of initially, I hate the heat. I really dislike the heat. I'm much happier in a cold place. Heat is a problem for me. I get very hot. I don't know how to deal with it. And this was in the south of France. What I did was that I started working in the river. I actually sat in the river and made works, which was obviously cooler. So I started working in the river with these coloured stones, making lines that gradated from grey to white to yellow to red. And I began painting with stones. And underneath the water, the effects of the water made the stones disappear, but the colour rise out. So I turned the stone to liquid colour in the river. And that was best at the middle of the day when the sun was at its hottest, because the sun was high and cast no shadow. So I turned what had originally been the most difficult time of the day in which for me to work to a sculpture that needed to be made at that time. That was a fantastic moment. And up till then, in hot places, I generally start getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning, working, retreating in the middle of the day, and then coming out at night again. And somehow I always feel that's not dealing with the place properly, you know? So I do feel that if I can deal with it head on at its most difficult and make a great work, that is how it should be.
So there's that physical challenge for you.
Oh, I need that. When I'm in a gallery or work doing installations inside, I can only work for so long before the energy begins to drain out.
I want to talk about this sense of reversing nature. And what I'm thinking of is you're bringing these giant snowballs into the middle of London on a summer day. What inspires you to do that sort of thing?
The snowballs were left on the streets of London on Midsummer's Day. We put them out on the streets in the middle of the night, so nobody knew how they got there.
What were people's reactions?
Well, there was a disbelief that it was snow, and then I actually held a press conference that morning. I knew I would be fighting for the life of the snowball, so to speak, and that they could have lasted 10 minutes. People could have just, attacked them, and some of them lasted for 3 or 4 days. Most of them survived for a lot longer than I thought they would.
You have an important sense of place in your work. You did an exhibit at the Met, at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, where you imported 30 rocks from Scotland to the rooftop of the Met. How come you just didn't use 30 rocks that you found, let's say, in Central Park?
There are occasions where, generally speaking, I like to work with the material that I find in a place. That's interesting. Also important to me is not just the rocks that I find, but movement and journeys and materials and also people take. And this journey from Europe to America is one that I do a lot, but it's got a long history to it, especially from Scotland. And granite bowls, it's Scottish granite, but there's, granite below you in the park. So I wanted to make that connection.
I want to talk about your personal life for a moment. You are divorced.
I am divorced, yeah.
How many children do you have?
I've got 4 kids.
What impact does the work have on your personal life?
Well, it is my personal life. It has no boundaries to the making of art. I mean, it encroaches or enriches, depends how you look on it, on everything that I do.
You're married to it.
Yeah, yeah.
Where do you source your inspiration?
When I went to Bradford Art School, there was a lot of performance and happenings works. People out there on the streets doing works on predictable things, which really informed me an awful lot. This idea of art being out of the studio in real places, and the unpredictability of that. And nature has always been. And nature is not for me this kind of pastoral idyll that it's often perceived to be. The subject of nature is something that is supposed to be quaint and pretty. I mean, nature for me has always been very raw and harsh and brutal and beautiful too. Mm. It's been the most difficult subject matter, not the easy option that people like to think of it sometimes.
You were also inspired by graves at St. Patrick's Church somewhere in England. Didn't you take pieces of ice from the graves?
On occasion, I did. Yeah, but they would freeze over, and every so often I'd try and lift an entire human shadow, this kind of shape up. The shape of that informed a work nearby when I was where I was asked to do it was a private commission. I built 3 human-sized chambers for people to step into on top of this very bleak moor. The more people who step into this chamber, the more ingrained it will become with the memory of the people who stepped in there. And it is a place that's personally very important to me. But from that place, I could see the Morecambe Bay where I made my very first works. I could see the Morecambe where I was a student. I could see the church at Caton where I got married, because my ex-wife's village was there. I could see another couple of villages that I'd lived in. So there were all these places that I'd been in, had a relationship with, but was no longer there. And it was this sense that even though I'm not there, I still am connected to those places, that I've left a presence there.
How do you think you'll be entombed? You know, we're talking about graves, and there's a picture of you in one of your books throwing sand up in the air and just seeing wherever it would land, and it reminds me of cremated ashes. I'm wondering if you've ever thought about that for yourself.
Well, I have my father's ashes, which I'm going to make a throw from those at some point. But at the moment, it's in my will that I be buried next to the cairn that I made outside of Penpont, the village from where I live. And this work was made in response. The village asked me to make a millennium sculpture, and it stands there as a guardian to the village. So I would like to be buried next to that.
Mm. Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you very much for asking me.
My guest has been Andrew Goldsworthy. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at FromScratchRadio.com or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.